Good morning. You guys get to be take two. The guinea pigs were already here at the early service. So we're continuing on in our anonymous series, a series where we are talking about individuals that are revealed to us in the scriptures that aren't necessarily named, but they show us great characteristics of faith in differing levels. Today being no different, we're going to use as our text primarily today Luke chapter 7, but we will also be referring to Matthew chapter 8, which is Matthew's account of the same events. So I thought we'd start out this morning with some real simplistic things. If you had to define faith, how would you define it? Webster tells us, and of course we know Webster's all-knowing, Webster tells us that faith is a strong belief or confidence in something or someone. Now, I would venture to say that probably everybody in here this morning, in a very small scale, demonstrated some faith this morning. How many of you set an alarm clock so you could get up on time this morning? How many of you used an electrical appliance or turned on your lights this morning? How many of you went out and got in your car to drive to church this morning? Okay. While very small, those are all examples of faith to a degree. We have faith that, be it your phone, be it a true alarm clock, whatever the case may be that you set this morning or last night to get you up this morning, we believed it would go off when it was supposed to and wake us up when it was supposed to. Now, you may be like some people I know that the alarm clock goes off and they smack it four or five times for that 15 minutes of extra sleep and then get up to scramble out of the house, but they still have confidence that it's going to do what it was supposed to do. If you've paid your electric bill, then you're pretty confident if you flip the switch on this morning, the lights are going to come on. A little bit of faith in the electric company and the transmission lines and whatnot to get the electricity to your house. And if you went out the door this morning, and if you're like those individuals that slammed the alarm four or five times to be right on time getting out the door, and you get to your vehicle, you have faith that it's going to start up and get you where you're going on time. And in all those cases, if something doesn't work, how out of sorts does that put your day? Your alarm clock didn't go off and you slept through it and you're late for work, that kind of puts a little hindrance on your day. If you slam the alarm four or five times and you're just getting out on time and you go out and your car don't start, puts a little kink in your day. And if for some reason you flipped on the lights this morning and it's dark outside and they didn't come on, really puts a kink in your day. If you can't turn the coffee pot on in my world, that really puts a kink in your day. But those are all small examples of worldly faith, if you will. Scriptures define faith for us this way. In Hebrews chapter 11, the scriptures tell us, where do I get the right spot? Works better. That faith is being sure of what we hope for and certain of what we do not see. And if you read through Hebrews 11, it's known as the Great Faith Chapter, and it talks about some of the gentlemen of the Old Testament and the great faith that were displayed through various acts that they did. But I want to hang on to that definition, that we are sure of what we hope for and certain of what we do not see. In today's text, we're going to find an individual that we probably wouldn't, at first glance, equate him to a lot of faith in that realm. It's someone that, you know, we'll find out a little bit about his character, but under normal circumstances is probably not somebody that we would associate immediately with great faith. And by the same token, it's probably somebody that he's going to place some faith in, somebody that he probably doesn't know a great deal about. It's kind of a testimony to that individual, if you will. We're going to look at Christ's ministry. The timeline for this is probably about a year to a year and a half into Christ's ministry. And as we begin, you put the Gospels together, this is probably right on the tail of the Sermon on the Mount. Christ has completed the Sermon on the Mount. He's handed out the Beatitudes. He's given us all some directives of do's and do's nots for our life. And he comes down off the mountainside. And Luke tells us in verse 1 that when Jesus had finished saying all this, in the hearing of the people, he entered Capernaum. Capernaum being a small town near the Sea of Galilee. A lot of the Bible scholars think that that first verse of Luke is probably actually the tail end of chapter 6. And a lot of their thinking there is, if you back up to Matthew, and I'll read it for you, at the tail of the Beatitudes in Matthew chapter 7, verse 28, it says, when Jesus finished saying these things, that being the Sermon on the Mount, the crowds were amazed at his teaching because he taught as one who had authority and not as the teachers of the law. Now, I don't know about you. I've read that verse a lot of times. I've thought about that verse a lot of times. For me, I'd really like to hear one of Jesus' sermons. When they describe his teaching, it just intrigues me. I would really like to hear one of his sermons. I've had, be it fortunate or unfortunate, I've had opportunities to sit through meetings over the years where you get a whole lot of stuff thrown at you that's supposed to stick. Most of it goes in one ear and out the other, but it's supposed to stick. And in some of those meetings, you can tell the difference between a speaker that is very well prepared, that knows what they're talking about, and somebody who is not necessarily so prepared. And even in that context, thinking back on some of the speakers that I have heard over the years that were very well versed, very well prepared, and I think about what they said about Jesus, there must be a tremendous difference even in that context of the speaking. And I would, we'll get our chance someday to hear Jesus preach, but I really am waiting for that. But both Matthew and Mark from that point go on. It says that there was there in verse 2, there a centurion's servant whom his master highly valued was sick and about to die. Matthew relays for us that this sickness actually brought on paralysis, that the servant was paralyzed. If you read the two accounts, they sound a little bit different, but they are of the same account. Luke is going to tell us, as we move forward a little bit, that it's not the centurion himself that comes to speak to Jesus. It's actually a group of the Jewish leadership that come to speak to Jesus. Matthew describes it as the centurion himself coming to speak to Jesus. Most of the scholars equate that to just a difference in writing style. More than likely, Matthew's giving us a somewhat abbreviated version, as he tends to do in some cases. Luke, if you recall, Luke is a doctor. So consequently, he's very in tune to detail, to giving us the whole picture, if you will. The other thing for Luke is Luke very much likes to highlight the fact that when a Gentile is involved in a good light, Luke likes to highlight that very well because of his status. But at any rate, we find out that this centurion has got a servant who's in need of some desperate help, that he is about to die, as the scriptures tell us. Now for informational purposes, we're going to find out, Luke is going to share with us some characteristics of this particular centurion. But just as a point of interest, a typical centurion in the day, if you think about leadership in a military role, I'm sure each one of us have a little bit of an envisionment of what we perceive to be a military style leader. And that kind of being my point of him being someone that you probably wouldn't associate a lot of faith with. At least for me, I wouldn't. A typical centurion in the day of the Roman army, as the name would imply, was a commander over about 100 troops or 100 soldiers. It could be, you know, if you read some of the accounts, it could be anywhere from 80 to 100 soldiers that a centurion typically would have charge of. Centurion would gain his role by working his way up through the ranks. A centurion would start out as a foot soldier, and as the leaders of the military took notice of his ability to perhaps lead a little bit, his ability to show courage, different things that they perceived as good characteristics, that would move his promotion up through the military ranks. A centurion would be extremely loyal to the Roman army and the Roman government. A centurion would show courage, which would be one of the things that would be part of them promoting him through the ranks. Centurions were noted or described in a lot of realms as the backbone of the Roman army. The centurion, if you think about today's army, is equated to about a lieutenant in today's world of thinking. One of the big factors for a centurion is they would lead their troops into battle. It wasn't a go do this and I'll see you when you get back kind of deal. When it came to actual battle, the centurion was normally at the forefront of the lines heading into battle. And one of the things for a centurion, they would dress very much like the rest of the Roman army, usually with the exception of their headgear. Their headgear would be very different. If you've looked at a lot of the accounts of the Roman army, they had, I call it a brush. It looks like a brush on the top of their headgear that they wore. But that was a purpose. The purpose of that headgear was to make them very noticeable, in particular to their own troops. So when they went into battle, the troops following him in could see that, you know, this courageous guy is up in the front leading the way. He's still moving forward. Henceforth, we should be moving forward. So they're all characteristics that we would think of with a normal centurion. This particular centurion, we're going to find out from Luke, portrayed a few additional characteristics, if you will. If we go back to our text, Luke, with the leadership coming we'll read from verse 3. It says, "A centurion heard of Jesus and sent some elders of the Jews to him, asking him to come and to heal his servant. When they came to Jesus, they pleaded earnestly with him, 'This man deserves to have you do this, because he loves our nation and has built our synagogue.'" Again, we see several unusual circumstances in the context of this. For the Jews and a Roman soldier to be getting along, not the most common thing in the world in that day. The Jews did not have a lot of love for the Roman army, for the Roman rule, for the Romans in general. They viewed Rome as holding them down, not allowing them to be their own government, not allowing them to be in charge of themselves, which in reality was true. By the same token, the Romans were not great fans of the Jewish community for the most part. They viewed the Jewish community to a degree as a troublesome group because the Jews so desired to be their own rule. There was oftentimes some friction between the two groups. But this particular centurion, in some fashion, has shown compassion to the Jewish group that was there, has in some way interacted with them to gain a favorable status with them. And it tells us that, you know, Luke relays to us that he actually helped to build the synagogue there. Obviously, in every one of the towns where there was a Jewish populace, they generally had a synagogue. If you read through the book of Acts and you look through Paul's travels, wherever Paul went, his first stop was always at the synagogue. So it wasn't uncommon that there were a lot of synagogues around, obviously. The building of a synagogue would obviously require some financial capacity. A typical Roman foot soldier in that day earned about 300 denarii annually. Denarii, if you look in your scriptures, is about a day's wages. A centurion, on the other hand, earned about 5,000 denarii. So they were pretty well off in that realm, which makes sense when you think that he had a servant. You'd have to have a little bit of collateral to be able to have a servant. So this particular centurion used his own financial means, and he may well have used his troops to aid in the building of this synagogue and gaining the favor of the Jews. And I would suspect that he has also reasoned that this God that the Jews served is for real. Otherwise, I can't understand why he would put out his finances and his capacity to potentially put himself in a position that's not going to be real favorable with his leaders and his superiors. Luke relays for us that he heard about Jesus. Now, it doesn't tell us a great deal there. It doesn't tell us how much he heard about Jesus. He doesn't tell us when he heard about Jesus. It doesn't tell us what he heard about Jesus. All he tells us is he heard about Jesus. My guess would be, if you go back to Matthew's passage at the end of the Sermon on the Mount, part of what Matthew relays to us is once Jesus came down off the mountain, that he performed a lot of healing to the crowd that was there, and then the crowd dispersed. Well, as you well know, people can't be quiet. So I'm for sure that all the healing that went on traveled, and they weren't that far from Capernaum. So whether this centurion just heard of Jesus, you know, following this event, or whether he has heard of some of the other events that have been a part of Jesus's ministry, we're not given that enlightenment, but he knows something about Jesus and has deemed in his mind that I need to ask this guy for help. Now, again, you know, you think about the typical, at least in our mindset for the most part, we think about a typical Roman soldier. You wouldn't think they would have a great deal of concern for a servant, a slave. You know, you wouldn't foresee that being in the forefront of their thinking. You know, well, this one died, I'll buy another one and replace him. Not a big deal. But to the centurion, from what I was reading, a couple other things that are notable. Centurions were typically a 20-year term of service, if you will. And one of the things for the centurion was they weren't allowed to marry during those 20 years. So consequently, they didn't have family. And their servants, in a lot of cases, they would become very close with their servants to the point that the servant quite potentially could be viewed as a family member. And a lot of the commentaries think in this particular case that this centurion may well have viewed this servant much like a son, which is why he had such a deep concern in this instance. Whatever the case, he has surmised that Jesus can help this situation. And, you know, Matthew's account says the servant went and asked Jesus himself. Luke's account tells us that the leadership went on his behalf and asked Jesus. Both accounts agree that Jesus agreed to help. And the wording for most of them is, I'll come and heal him, or I'll go and heal him. Now, again, that in and of itself presents an interesting series of potential issues. Jesus is a Jew. The centurion is a Gentile. Jews didn't go into Gentiles' houses. That was just not done. If you move forward, you think to the end of Jesus' life, when the crowds were trying to get him crucified, when the leadership took him to Pilate, the leadership would not go into the palace to approach Pilate. They made Pilate come out to them because they didn't want to defile themselves entering the Jewish or the Gentiles' place of residence. So there was a big deal there for a Jew to be going into a Gentile's home. But Jesus has agreed he's going to go heal this guy. And as we continue forward, we find out that in Luke's account, it says, so Jesus went with them. When he was not far from the house, he was not far from the house when the centurion sent friends to him. Lord, don't trouble yourself, for I don't deserve you to deserve to have you come under my roof. That's why I didn't even consider myself worthy to come to you. But say the word and my servant will be healed, for I myself am a man under authority with soldiers under me. I tell this one, go, and he goes. I tell that one, come, and he comes. I tell this one to do this, and he does it. Again, there are several lines of thinking. The centurion may well have enough knowledge of the Jewish thought process to know that for Jesus to come into his house could be a great problem for Jesus, and may well have been looking out for Jesus' best interests and telling him not to come into the house. That could be part of the scenario here. Don't know that to be a fact, but it's some lines of thought. But more so than that, we get to see a little bit of the understanding that this military guy has in the realm of authority and authority being displaced. As he words it there, he's a man under authority. He was the voice of the emperor in the region he was at, over the 100 men that he was leading. In reality, if he spoke, if he gave an order, if he deemed something to be done, it was as if the emperor himself was making that command or giving that command. He had that authority. By the same token, he knew that he was in submission to the ruling authority. He knew where his place was. If they told him he needed to do something, he knew he needed to do it. He also understood that every order he gave out, he didn't have to be right there to see it completed. If he designated a group of his soldiers to go do X, he didn't have to go with them to see it get done. He was confident that he had displaced the order to them, that they were going to fulfill the duty as required. And by the same token, on the other side of that coin, if he would give such an order and the troop wouldn't fulfill that order, that was not only disobedience to him following the chain of authority, that was disobedience to the emperor and to Rome itself, all which would meet with consequence. But it would appear that he has surmised in his mind this same authoritative relationship with Jesus Christ and God the Father. He's realized that Jesus is under authority of God, that what Jesus is doing here on this earth, he's doing it because the Father has given him that job to do, given him that authority to do those things. And he's also apparently surmised that just as he can tell his soldiers to go do something, and he doesn't have to be there to see it, Jesus could say the word, not have to be right there, and provide that healing. Which, if you go back and you kind of look at the Matthew text, Matthew inserts a miracle in between the Sermon on the Mount and this particular event. He inserts the healing of the leper. And the healing of the leper required Christ, didn't require him, but Christ made a point when he healed the leper of touching the leper. And for all we know, at this point, all the miracles that Christ has performed have been up close and personal style miracles, with the exception of John. John records one potentially long distance miracle early in his writings, but that may well have occurred after this event. There's no timeline attached to that specifically. So, you know, this guy has surmised that Christ doesn't have to be there to make this miracle happen, which is some pretty good thinking in my mind, because he doesn't have anything to reference that against that we're aware of at this point. But again, he also surmises the authority side of things, that Jesus Christ is here under authority of God, with authority to do what God has deemed he should do. And Jesus himself relays that thought process several times throughout the scriptures. In John chapter 12, when Jesus is talking to some of the Jews, he tells them there in 12 and 44, that when a man believes in me, does not believe in me only, but also believes in the one who sent me. And a little further down in there, he says, I don't speak of my own accord, but the Father who sent me commanded me what to say, how to say it. I know that the command leads to eternal life, so whatever I say is just what the Father has told me to say. Jesus himself makes it very evident that he's under God's direction, under God's authority to be performing what he's doing here on this earth. And then one of the most notable things in this whole passage of Scripture, in verse 9 it says, when Jesus heard this, he was amazed at him. Jesus Christ was amazed at the faith this Gentile dog showed. The verbiage that is used here for amazed as it concerns Jesus Christ is only used one other time. And that would be when he was at Nazareth, and it tells us he was amazed at their lack of faith. Jesus Christ was truly impressed with the faith of this centurion. That to me says something. For Christ to be impressed, that says something. I'd like to think he'd be that impressed with my faith, but I'm not so sure. But he was genuinely impressed by what this centurion put forth in the realm of faith in Jesus Christ. And he goes on from there, and if you read, and we're going to flip back and read Matthew's account, because it's a very important twofold message that Christ is going to relay from that point on. In Matthew chapter 8, beginning in 10, it says, when Jesus heard this, Matthew uses the word astonished here, but it was the same amazed. He was astonished and said to those following, I tell you the truth, I've not found anyone in Israel with such great faith. This Gentile guy has got better faith than anybody I can find in my own countrymen. I say to you that many will come from the east and the west to take their places at the feast of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, in the kingdom of heaven. Christ is talking about the end times. Christ is talking about when he says from the east and the west, guess what, folks? He's letting us in. And he's telling those that are in hearing there, hey, Gentiles are going to get in too. Which again is some new thinking to the Jewish ears. Again, they have no good viewpoint of the Gentiles for the most part. But Christ tells them that the Gentiles are going to get in. These dogs are going to make their way to the wedding feast. And by the same token, in verse 12, he says, but the subjects of the kingdom are going to be thrown out into the darkness where there's weeping and gnashing of teeth. Those subjects of the kingdom are his Jewish brothers. And a lot of them, and the mentality is there still today, think that because they have the bloodline, they're sure to spot at the table. Jesus Christ is letting them know that it takes more than just being of the bloodline. You have to have faith in Jesus Christ if you're going to make it to the wedding supper. And for you and I and the group that heard it there, he tells us that hell is indeed a very real place. When he says they're going to be thrown out into the darkness, that's hell. You're going to be thrown out of the presence of God. You're going to be thrown somewhere that you ain't going to enjoy. You think it's been hot outside here for the last week and a half? Revelation describes hell as burning sulfur, the lake of fire, and they add a little thing in there that's called you'll be tormented day and night. He's trying to tell his brethren, shape up. Put your faith where it belongs. I came here for a reason. I came here to provide salvation. And guess what? If you don't believe in me, the alternative is not so good. Okay? Message is no different for us today. We've been given the pathway to salvation through Jesus Christ. On the day of Pentecost, Peter preached the first gospel sermon. And he laid out the message for them, how to attain salvation. 2,000 years later, it hasn't changed a bit. We still have the same road to salvation. We have to believe that Jesus is who he said he was. We need to repent of our sins. We need to submit to baptism. And we start our walk anew, following Jesus Christ. No different today than it was 2,000 years ago. And if you don't want to be tormented day and night, and God, remember, folks, this is forever. You know, we think about our life here on this earth. Paul describes us as a vapor that appears for a little while. You know, if you live to be 100 years old, that's doing something. That's nothing compared to eternity. Eternity is eternity. And you're going to spend one of two places, as I like to call it, smoking or non-smoking. I prefer non-smoking. And on the heels of all of this, as kind of an afterthought on both texts, they relay to us that Jesus told the centurion or told the followers to go, that it would be done as they had asked. And the servant was healed from that very moment. Jesus didn't have to go touch him. Jesus didn't have to see him. Jesus didn't have to do anything other than say the word. And the servant was healed. The centurion displayed a great faith that Jesus Christ could heal his servant, a great faith that Jesus Christ was who he said he was. We have a couple of other instances in the scriptures where we're introduced to some centurions. In particular, I think about the centurion that was at the foot of the cross when Jesus died. He made the proclamation that surely this was the Son of God. He saw enough events that day to convince him that Jesus was the Son of God. This centurion, I would say, has surmised that this Jesus is the Son of God, that he is who he says he is. And he had enough faith to ask him to do him a favor and was confident that it would happen. Today for us, no difference. Our faith is in going to spend eternity with Jesus Christ. Our faith is that Jesus Christ has opened the doors to salvation. Our faith is that when it's all said and done, when this body is over, we're going to have a new body in a new home that's going to live forever. And the goal for me for that new body is to spend it with God. We look at the book of the Revelation and it talks to us a little bit about what heaven's going to be. I can't begin to envision it, but it tells us important stuff. You know, the streets we're going to walk on are going to be made out of gold. That's how much value God puts in gold. The stuff that we value so much on the world today, here on this earth, is not of much value when we get to heaven. Jesus Christ came here with a plan and a purpose. The plan was to provide salvation to mankind. The purpose is to take as much of mankind as he can to heaven with him. Satan's here with a plan and a purpose too. Satan's plan is to not get you to heaven, but spend eternity in torment with him. And he's got the same goal. He wants to take as many people as possible with him. So today, if you are outside of Jesus Christ, you've got a decision to make. Do you have the faith that tells you that Jesus Christ is who he says he was? Do you believe it? Will you confess it? And will you begin a walk anew with him? Today could be that day. The baptism's here. The steps to salvation are no different than they were 2,000 years ago. And today, as the group comes to lead us in our final song, the plan is in place. The worst part of it has been fulfilled. Jesus Christ has already died, risen, and opened the doors for us. Our job is to believe and follow. So if you have a decision to make today, I invite you to come while the group leads us in singing.